Associated Podcast. For the last few months in quarantine, I've been running polls on Twitter, and we've kind of now set up my own account to run these polls, one every month, and talk about them. We're doing a podcast each month is the plan. So this month, the poll has been about cover versions. So I have got with me Pete.
Hello.
Sis.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hello.
To talk about cover versions, roughly along the lines of the poll, but the poll hasn't actually finished yet, so we won't be able to talk about who has or hasn't won, but we can make a fairly good guess at the kind of things that are likely to win. There's a kind of covers canon that has emerged from the poll, which includes the likes of Johnny Cash's Hurt, Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You, and older, even older, since Sinead O'Connor's track is now 30 years old, but even older tracks like Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower, one of the kind of initial entries into this cover canon. So we're going to be exploring cover versions, what makes them good, what makes them less good, and what we've learned from our polular explorations. I guess the first thing is, do any of you have got a favourite cover version?
I'll tell you what I've discovered. I've discovered the Pointer Sisters version of Dirty Work from Steely Dan, which really kind of blew me away, even though it's quite similar to the original, but with Pointer Sistery difference. So that would be probably my discovery of the tournament. I don't know. How about you, Sis?
Well, that Pointer Sisters version is incredible. I would say the poll has made me think a lot about like what my favourite cover is and what things there are that make covers my favorite, so it has increased my sense that there is no cover that is my actual favorite, but it's made me think quite strongly about like what it is I like about certain kinds of covers and what it is I hate about many other covers that other people apparently like, but that's been a very strong vibe for me. The Black Bottle Brass Band, that version of Sexual Healing is so good. And also of Tom's, the one about making love down the end of the alley, making love down the end of the street.
Yeah.
Well, that is that one of yours?
Clarence Carter's Making Love, which is actually a cover of The Dark End of the Street, but he takes about 5 minutes before you get to the Dark End of the Street bit. And when it comes in, it's amazing.
It's amazing.
Because it's a very funny song, which is also quite a kind of terrifying, particularly if you have been cheating at the dark end of the street, I would imagine. But anyway, that was one of my nominations. All three of my nominations didn't even get into the poll. They were knocked out during the extremely lengthy and cruel and arbitrary series of qualifiers.
So what were your three nominations?
I nominated Ronnie Spector's You Can't Put Your Arms Around a Memory, the Johnny Thunders, which is a very straightforward cover of a song that I didn't know before I heard it as a cover.
Whereas it's the only version I know, yeah.
And I nominated Making Love at the Dark End of the Street. I nominated Losing My Mind by Liza Minnelli, which is sort of a cheat because it's a musical, but it's such a kind of, you know, it feels like the Pet Shop Boys doing almost the Pet Shop Boys kind of, the Pet Shop Boys and Liza Minnelli covering what would have been a Liza Minnelli track had she recorded it in 1972 or whenever. Yeah. And Pete, one of your nominations is still in.
Yes, A New England by Kirsty MacColl, which I think when we talk about kinds of covers, I think, again, it's one of those ones where a lot of people will only know that version, even though the Billy Bragg version is well known. It doesn't go very far, though it swaps the gender and is nicer, I think. The original has a hint of misogyny about it, which her version dodges. By the way, she changes the lyrics and so on. So yeah, and I think Kirsty MacColl, she had two songs do pretty well, Days, but her version of Days as well did really well. And of course there was, but she was a good interpreter of other people's materials. And also I think unfortunately I think Tracy Ullman's version of her song went out relatively early, but that was a little unfair to her, I think. Though she sings on the cover herself, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does the baby, because Tracy Ullman couldn't do it.
Yeah, and they don't know she does the baby. Sis, can you do the baby?
I can't do the baby. Only Kirsty is allowed to do the baby. That's the rules.
I think, I mean, actually, speaking of how the kind of gender role, Reversal in a New England, softened the song. That, of course, one of the, at the moment, the number one seed thing is Aretha Franklin's Respect, which obviously will be, as the pundits say, there or thereabouts near the end. And that, I think, clearly is a kind of the example of where being sung by a woman really quite radically changes the meaning of the song, and it kind of detoxifies the meaning of the song to some extent.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the sort of, you know, that's one of the kind of legendary meaning change and a great performance and it's a good song in the first place cover. So it hits a lot of bolts. But Mark, you I believe have got a discovery from the poll.
Well it wasn't, I actually discovered it about a month before the poll, but it is in the poll, and so it seems an interesting thing to talk about. I mean, on the whole, I'm not taking part in the poll because I'm busy with other things.
Yeah.
And I'm not terribly engaged by polls because I think, I mean, what I find interesting in a cover version is something which, to be a nerdy asshole about it, kind of expands the discursive space round a song. Mm-hmm. So I'm not kind of looking forward to seeing what wins, because I think I probably won't be very interested in that. The things that are likely to be the most interesting things are towards the middle, where there's some kind of to and fro over whether a reinterpretation, what it's bringing to it. The actual song you're probably nudging me to talk about, William Shatner's version of Common People, which is a song I was excited to discover, because it's the original is not a song I like all that much, and it's a song which I think has been sort of heavily overinterpreted in one political reading, which I don't think entirely stands up. And I like the way that Shatner brings various elements of his kind of professional skill and his professional persona to destabilize that, and sort of take that out of the abstract. What I mean, the power gradient within the original song has always seemed to me a bit sus, because on one hand the singer is sort of assumed to be angry about someone who has more privilege than him, speaking in a way where they don't understand what it is they're enthusing about, but it's actually being sung through the persona of someone who is a beloved indie pop star who, by not very long after the success of the song, it seems to me, has significantly more cultural power than an anonymous ex of his who he is complaining, who is not speaking in her own first language. So it seems to me unkind to be taking issue with the way she expresses English phrases, the way that she picks up on something which 200 years ago was the normal expression of the people she's making an alliance with for themselves. Common people is exactly people in the 18th century described themselves when they were angry about power imbalance, but whatever. 200 years later, obviously it isn't, but this person is Greek, not English, and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, what William Shatner brings to it is it's much more evident that he is aware of his cultural power, and he's actually, I think, quite playful about the fact that probably in this song, he's actually the asshole and not her. And then that is offset with the fact that the singing is by Joe Jackson, who's perhaps not really particularly famous at all, the least famous person of all in this little gradient of privilege that I'm talking about. And Joe Jackson's singing is completely unhinged with distressed anger. And so I just think it's a very nice arrangement by someone who I haven't really spent much time thinking about, Ben Folds. And I think it does a lot of stuff in quite a complicated song that the original didn't really get round to doing.
You have sold it very well.
Yeah.
I feel...
It's no good. And I hate it. I hate it with a passion. But you have sold it well.
Yeah, I feel so much more positive about it than I have ever done in my life, and that I ever will after the next 5 minutes.
What,
where, like, this is going to buoy me. And then the next time I think about the song, I'm going to be like...
No, it's good.
I'll admit I've been voting on the slightly more prosaic grounds of, am I enjoying listening it? and I found it wanting generally in the initial thing. It was actually up against two other William Shatner songs, and I do think it was the deserved victor.
Which in itself isn't saying that much. I think it's interesting. I mean, I wanted to mention Ben Folds, who also turns up on his own in the list with his version of Dr. Dre's Bitches Ain't Shit, which is a really interesting one, which I think shows a lot about the... it's a gag, you know. I mean, Ben Folds did a few of these things and did quite a lot of these kind of, here I am, I'm a piano player, I can arrange anything and I can sing anything. And I think he had a kind of existential crisis when he did, or not when he did it, it's a funny song and people like it for that reason, I think. He does it well, but he turns what is, you know, a gangster rap song into a Ben Folds song. And it sounds like a Ben Folds song. It sounds like all Ben Folds songs do. And I think at that point he realised that, yes, he had the ability to make any song sound like a Ben Folds song, but that's no good if people don't like Ben Folds songs. And I think he's moved around afterwards. I think that partially, I think, this project with William Shatner comes a bit out of it, and some of his other stuff he's done with other artists since. I mean, because he does seem to be much more of the interested in arranging in music around that area now, because he basically exhausted what he could do in sounding like himself.
I mean, I think the other thing about that song, because when I was arranging the groups, I noticed that we had a number of what you might call, I mean, I called the group Ironic Rap, and actually I'm not sure that ironic is exactly the right word, but it was, for want of a better word, white indie guys and girls doing hip-hop songs. And so I put all these together on the grounds that it was a similar approach, and also it kind of drew the sting of the novelty element of it, or of the joke element, sort of saying, well, actually, you've got to choose between four of these. And the one that won was Boom Shake the Room by MJ Hibbert, which I do think was the best. But I think it comes from a kind of place of love, which I can't totally say that Bitches Ain't Shit by Ben Folds is. And that, like, first of all, am I wrong? But also, does that matter? Like, does it, if you're covering a song that you don't like, might that not kind of take you to somewhere more interesting?
Yeah, I mean, one of the songs that I discovered again through this is the Jenny Owens Young's version of Hot In Here. And I think that is exactly the same as what you're saying. But again, I think they all come from a degree of love. But I think the bit of love which comes with, but wouldn't it be funny if I did this? I don't think anyone's doing songs they don't necessarily like, but I do think that there is the gag is there.
I think the Fatima Mansions Everything I Do It For
Okay,
You,
yeah. Yes.
Which is terrible, yes. Is a song that they didn't like.
Yeah, but I think in this little subset, but I do think that, yeah, the central gag of here's me doing my strummy guitar singer-songwritery stuff to this hip-hop song is enough of a gag in some place. I think with Hibbert's Boom Shake the Room, it works very well live, and it's a good call and response. The original has the call. It works in exactly the same way, whilst at the same time juxtaposing MJ Hibbert's persona onto the Fresh Prince's persona, which is...
There's a difference, I think, between doing a performance in your style, where you're sort of rescuing a song that you think is good but hidden under a bad arrangement or cheesy arrangement or whatever, or lost inside a genre which you don't have respect for. I think the Hibbert's version, I don't think he's doing that at all. I think it's much more like, this is a great song, whatever sort of handy busker's style you apply to it, the greatness of the song prevails, which I think is almost exactly the opposite of indie covers of Britney or something like that, where there seems to be a kind of very much looking down on the mere commercial arrangement at what is apparently secretly a very fine song hidden. And I think those are different things going on.
Yeah, I think however that conversation happens, it is patronising one way or another. You're either saying, I have discovered this amazing song that's in a terrible genre, look at my musicianship can lift up this song which is otherwise lost, or look how I can make it a better song. So, you know, if we're going to call Baby One More Time by Travis the troublemaker in this field, which I think we all agree it is, it's still in that genre conversation back then where, you know, indie fans didn't like pop, I don't think it works the same way now, because I think that Rubicon had been crossed.
I think there's also another shift that's kind of happened, which is that I feel like there was a period where the cover of a hip-hop song in a significantly more, like, into a different style was much more popular, and people felt it was more kind of okay. I'm kind of thinking there was that period where you had bluegrass version, like there's a bluegrass version of Gin and Juice, there's a bluegrass version of Hit 'Em Up Style by Blue Contrell, and especially with that version of Gin and Juice, which I actually really like, there's a thing which is like, this is funny because we're doing it in what is considered to be a white way, when the song, it, you know, there was a kind of dodgy early 2000s racism thing going on there,
the Blue Contrell cover, of course, is done by
a black group, so it's this thing of actually, you know, the bluegrass roots are, you know, country music was made by black people, and that's also the same period that you have like Radio Dread and quite a lot of like look at this song, what if I did it in a totally different genre. This is Pete's theory that all covers are just about showing off, but it's just a kind of like, look, I took this thing and I am capable of turning it into this other thing.
My theory is all covers are showing off, but as I think about it, all performance is showing off, so really it doesn't matter. Doesn't really narrow it down.
None of the Radio Dread ones were voted on, but the same kind of outfit, the Easy Star All Stars, their version of Pink Floyd's Dub Side of the Moon, a track from that was in. And I think some of it is the extent to which, you know, these bands are willing to kind of commit to the bit. And if you're going to kind of do a whole album with a bunch of kind of full-on reggae veterans, and you're doing the entire thing, and you're trying to really work out how all the different noising kind of folder roll that Tom York or Roger Waters or whoever packs into the music, how to translate those things, then it becomes a lot more sort of palatable than just, oh, we're doing this in this genre and it's funny. All of these things are kind of questions of craft. And I think you've got this whole idea of covers bands. And there was a few kind of covers bands that were nominated and actually did very badly. People roundly rejected both the songs from Postmodern Jukebox, whose shtick is that they play modern pop in a kind of pre-war style.
And it really struck out. It was really obvious, clear to me that no one wanted to put anything Nouvelle Vague on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember when Nouvelle Vague was a thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were good.
You know, you can still have
a
dinner party.
I don't think these are bad things. No, exactly. What I'm saying is that these are kind of gigging musicians, and Postmodern Jukebox, this is their job. They go around, this is what they do. They do a whole, like, Nouvelle Vague did 8 albums of this stuff, and are still kind of doing the circuit, the kind of novelty cover circuit, and they fulfill a particular role, which is, we're talking from the point of view of basically music nerds who listen to all the time and kind of have quite strong opinions about the values or not of various things, whereas there is a role for the covers band that is simply going out there and playing, and it's kind of, oh, I know this one, but it's in a different style, that's entertaining, and that's, you know, that's the sole level of engagement you have with it.
So if you're at a wedding and you don't have a DJ, but you do have a mariachi band, because that's the kind of band you have at your wedding, then if they're playing songs that you know, that may, there's a range of possible, of, you know, the pop space is huge, and you could just locate it in kind of traditional or modern mariachi, but it could also be, yeah, cover versions of Michael Jackson songs or Kraftwerk songs or whatever, which would somehow be appealing to the guests because of their age, sensibility. So I think that element of just translation between spheres is a kind of straightforwardly functional aspect, which is actually pretty easy to overlook from our perspective.
There is a conversation about novelty records and the novelty cover, obviously. But I think also, if your job is as a jobbing band out there is to get bums on seats, then it is sometimes, on the one side, having something that people know when they come along to see you is going to help. But also, you know, I was thinking, as we were just talking about kind of cover bands, of Dred Zeppelin, who had not one but two bits of shtick, which was doing Led Zeppelin songs in a reggae style, plus a singer who was an Elvis impersonator. And it's kind of like, yeah, this is shtick. This is a comedy show, but also music. And, you know, the serious music fan often doesn't like the idea that comedy can have any say in this.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's the whole show business thing, is why the early Beatles albums are full of cover versions. Some of them very good, some of them really not very good. But it's sort of, okay, bums on seats, what do the punters want? What do they already know? And so you've got this whole repertoire, and then they were then able to cash in on once they became famous.
Which, that thing of the functional cover version. Yeah, I sing Japanese music, and there's this thing where you have a specific repertoire of songs which are by now mostly, you know, 40 years old. And it's kind of, if you're having a gig, it's a wedding or something, you sing, you know, you're like, I'm going to sing Yimpi, I'm going to sing Ulur Kambang. There are all these songs which are, to varying extents, you can demonstrate some kind of ability or some kind of interpretative power. But quite a lot of it is just like, can this person do this song in the way that I want it to be heard? And that is a form of cover version, which is almost just doing a version of a standard. Take My Favorite Things. We've had John Coltrane's My Favorite Things in there, and it's very clear that like that is something being done to a song which is in the repertoire. Whereas if you have, I don't know, like Nat King Cole's version of, is it Nat King Cole's version of Perhaps, Perhaps, Perhaps? Like, is that a cover? Yeah. He's just singing a song that everyone knows. You know, it's not, that doesn't feel like a cover in the same way.
I think, yeah, whereas there's a sense that that if a song already exists, there's a sense that if a song already exists and is well known and been covered by so many people, it just becomes as part of the repertoire. Mm-hmm. Now, when that happens and how that happens is a bit weirder when we talk about pop music. Songs normally do have a stamp of the original writer, but it comes into that sort of, again, that rockist problem about bands writing their own song.
Or like when Carole King records on Tapestry a song that has already been recorded by a different artist, but it's her song. There's a kind of, which one is the original? Is it the one for which we have the first successful recorded version, and we judge everything against the first successful recorded version? Or do we have to find some other metric to identify the original that then becomes the covered?
I think there's a danger when you're just saying, is it the repertoire, of assuming that there's a sort of single shared repertoire which every musician in the world somehow can tap into. And I don't think that's even slightly true once you're starting talking. I mean, just if we're bringing up what the space of My Favorite Things is for jazz musicians in the late 50s and early 60s, actually it must be later than that, the sound of music, whatever the date of that is, it wasn't in the jazz repertoire. There was a pretty set, you know, the people had a kind of book which was the songs you're likely to be playing. And the reason for that was because not everyone knew all the chords to every song, but you might suddenly find yourself on the stand having to play whatever it was so that you could surreptitiously scrabble through and pick up the pretty quickly. But that wasn't part of that. I mean, it's an old-fashioned style song, but it was a relatively new song. And Coltrane using it was... And it's a funny mixture of intentions, I think. I think one is to say, well, I can use this to do what I do and to transform it, useful for that. So perhaps it should go into the repertoire. But also, I think it is deliberately contrasted the kinds of song which jazz musicians were routinely using to perform with.
Yeah, my point was that was a cover. Like, Coltrane's version is a version. Or you could say Summertime. If a jazz singer sings Summertime, they're just singing. When Sublime cover Summertime, it's definitely a cover. But then also when, like, the famous Janis Joplin cover Summertime, like, is that...
And also, there are some things which, in any kind of technical sense, they are covers, but they're also so much better known than the original. Like, Louie Louie by the Kingsmen is still in the poll. There is no way that... kind of this time 2 weeks ago, whenever I put the poll together, that I realised Louie Louie was a cover. Or I kind of knew that it was a song that was sort of knocking around and that loads of people recorded it. But I had no particular reason to believe that there had been an original Louie Louie that had come out like 8 years previously.
No, and that's when the cover becomes the original almost, isn't it? Yeah.
It just had never occurred to me to kind of imagine an original of Louie Louie. And in fact, I still haven't gone and listened to it.
No, I mean, the cover I wanted to talk about on this front in some ways, which is about why intentionality and so on, is Faith No More's version of Easy. Because it all struck me when it came out, it was like, well, this really isn't in any way that different to the original, apart from it's done by a metal band and they're doing it really, really straight. And so, you know, you don't really gain much by the version existing. But it does seem to me there's a conversation being had between Faith No More, their fans, and the music business in general, sort of saying, well, look, we have the musician he chops to do this. We like this song. We're not taking the piss. But the problem with all those intersections is it therefore doesn't need to exist.
So it's genre musicians saying, look, we can in fact play it perfectly straight. We're not trapped in the genre that we're known for, and we're not limited by that. We can also do real music, except obviously they wouldn't use that particular term. But that seems to me the gesture you're suggesting.
I mean, I also think, particularly with Faith No More, they had the reputation of being a very sort of, you know, split prone. Like, there was a lot of tension within the band over what Mike Patton wanted to do, over what the other people in Faith No More who weren't Mike wanted to do. And Mike Patton's other stuff is like 20 different genres. He's very much a kind of genre mashup guy. So there is this kind of like, you know, is he challenging the industry? Is he challenging fans? Is he challenging himself? Is he trying to piss off his bandmates? There could be like loads and loads of things going into the song choice. But those questions are considerably more fascinating than anything that actually comes out of the speakers when you put on Easy by Faith No More. So that is an issue, I guess. But you know, it was a big hit, and it was strongly embraced by them.
Yeah, I mean, and there was also, again, referred to back further on as well, that, you know, it comes from, you know, a black band and it's a white band doing it, and there's all sorts of tensions that sit around, you know, the genre. You know, metal is, or at least back then, was very much a genre. If you were a metal fan, you kind of hated everything else, and so the kind of just mere acceptance that you might like a song that your parents liked was, you know, is actually quite a radical statement in back then.
When is back then? What date is it?
It's 94, 93.
It's earlier, I think, but only a year or so.
Yeah. The other thing I was sort of interested in talking about is because there's a Sinead O'Connor cover in the list, it started me thinking, and actually I spent the afternoon mainly listening, her LP purely of covers, Am I Not Your Girl, which from 92. And I think there's an interesting sort of period where it's somewhat to do with a sense of anxiety or perhaps even exhaust within the pop world, sense of itself and sense of its priority, that some figures within it were beginning to sort of, as it were, take their fans by the shoulders and say, look, there's a much wider world of music out there that begins long before the Beatles, begins long before Elvis. And these songs are, Sinead O'Connor's reasoning, it's like, I love to sing these songs, I sing them well, they suit me and I suit them. And if you admire what I do, then you should be opening up your ears, this world of the past, to the music of your parent as well, or in fact, in her case, her grandparents. Elvis Costello had sort of done a similar thing about a decade before.
Because Sinead plays that, if I remember that thing, that's the one with Success Has Made a Failure of Our Home.
Yes.
Because she plays that song, and I presume I'm not sure I've ever heard the LP, but like pretty straight.
The arrangements are played pretty straight. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the songs are from a variety of periods and are a variety of styles, but it has it's arranged all by one person who escapes, and it has a stylistic coherent result.
What it's not doing is what things like something like the Cole Porter tribute 1990 was doing, where a lot of kind of old Cole Porter songs were being arranged in a very quite aggressively 1990-ish style.
Right.
And that's almost the other side of the argument. Like, you know, we can bring these old songs up to date and sort of turn them into a thing that you, the kids, will want to listen to. In fact, turns out to be you two doing a trip hop.
What we always needed, what we always wanted.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I think another version of that conversation that Mark's having as well is, say, if a band who's got a very, very rabid fan base goes out and does a covers album to sort of say, look, there's a whole world of music out there, such as, say, Duran Duran's Thank You album with their version of 911 is a joke on it and White Lines are cool, which isn't as strong, let's say, as some of their other work, and in many ways completely kiboshed their comeback at the time.
Is it not as strong, do you feel, because in fact they overestimated their skills as musicians?
I think some of the song choices are ones that they shouldn't be doing, let alone could be doing. So I do think their version of 911 is a joke is a mistake. just falls from what they can bring to it and what they can, how they can sing it, how Simon Le Bon can sing it as a white man from the Midlands.
If you dial 911,
there's a pause yeah, there for me to play. Some of 911 is a joke.
Sorry.
And if you dial 911 in the Midlands, the concert would not be the same.
It would be a joke, Mark. It would be a joke.
Weird tone.
911 is a party line.
Yes.
Aside from Duran Duran, have you got any other examples of that, Pete? Because I think that I think there is a sense that some bands are kind of like doing it as, you know, Nirvana, actually, again, the only covers of by Nirvana that people nominated in the poll were the quite dull ones, in my opinion, yeah, that come from the acoustic unplugged gig. But the interesting part of the Nirvana covers repertoire were where they would be covering The Raincoats and The Vaseline and such like in a very, very overt, saying, you know, we are here to educate you. Mm. There was this very much this kind of didactic approach to covering it.
Yeah, that seemed to be very much the case in the early 90s, particularly with grunge and stuff like that, where it sort of said, we are nothing without this previous set of musicians. Go and listen to them. We can only make one album every 2 years anyway, so give them the money. I mean, I think that almost comes from Kurt Cobain's embarrassment that he was making shed loads of money and his heroes weren't. But yeah, I think there's quite a lot of that was going on back then.
You also find there's obviously I have a lot of feelings about Fei Wong doing covers of things, but in 1995 she released an album which is called Decadent Sounds of Fei, which is a covers album entirely of covers of, I think they're Teresa Teng songs. I'm going to double check that, because if I'm making the statement about it being the wrong person, I'm going to feel like an idiot. And Teresa Teng is a person from a previous generation of pop music whose records were often, because she was successful in Japan, there was a period where her music was considered decadent in the People's Republic of China. And so you weren't able to listen to them before then. So it was a kind of bringing the songs of Teresa Teng to a new audience, because even though she's from Hong Kong, she's a cantopop artist originally, she was very popular in mainland China. So that had a kind of, you know, she was pointing towards her roots. She was showing how she could use her dream poppy style to bring these older songs to life. But also there's an element of educating people about the many hits of Teresa Teng, who was a superstar, but, you know, didn't really seem that relevant in 1995. And that's a kind of, you know, that is the same model being used within a different
it's not dissimilar to arch misogynist and abuser Ryan Adams doing Taylor Swift's 1989. When he did that, it was
God,
all
I've
about
forgotten about that.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to bring it up in some ways.
I'm very angry.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. We can cut this out, but in the original confection of that, it's like, I know you all think that she is this disposable pop person, which nobody thought at the time anyway. But here's me making her pop songs wonderfully well in my style, which actually is a piece of his abuse in some ways, or is of a piece of his abuse.
Also, sorry, everyone's angry about this wretched thing which no one nominated anything by, but also like his style of like kind of, you know, boring Americana play is the style that she had already mastered, demonstrated the mastery of, and moved on from to make 1989.
And there is a genre of this which I really like, which is, there's a particular genre of music that I like, a micro genre, which is women covering Drake songs. So good. So there's things like Cellular Device by Erykah Badu, Marvin's Room by JoJo, which didn't manage to get into the main list, tragically, even though it is so good.
It was beaten by a Ting Ting's cover.
I'm angry. a Live Lounge cover as well, which we should get onto as a phenomenon. But there's Fall For Your Type by Angel Hayes. There's a version of, I think it's from Time to Time, where like it was a duet with Jenny Aiko and someone just cut Drake out. And those are kind of like, part of why they're good is that you know that Drake has been taken out from them. Like, it's not just that they're good songs, it's that also like there's a conversation that has happened here that you are left with the kind of, you can hear one side of, but you don't want to hear the other side to complete the conversation, because you know what it's going to be like. You know it's Drake. And also because he has this very particular like feminine, like his relationship with femininity, the way he talks about what he wants women to be like is so specific. that the idea of him being kind of like muffled and put in a box and somebody else taking over, it also feels narratively very satisfying. But yeah, they're in that kind of space of conversation that I think is makes for some really great cover.
And again, you're on that tightrope between this is a great song, but there's something about this song which needs critiquing or rethinking or.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like when you if you think about All Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, it's kind of, you know what this song needs is something that distracts you from the lyrics. So I'll play lots of loud guitar, and it'll work. You know, it fits. His version works because it is grandiloquent and different to the original, which is, you know, I think if his version didn't exist, it would be another Bob Dylan song from its period. I mean, I wanted to ask a little bit about this, about how malleable covers are, when something stops becoming a cover, when you drop lyrics, when you change lyrics. Because I think we were having a conversation elsewhere about whether parody songs are covers. So is Weird Al Yankovic's Eat It a cover or a extant different version of Beat It? But also something like Tricky's Black Steel, which only uses a bit of the song and does it quite differently. Is it a cover or is it a reinterpretation? Is it a new song in itself?
There's a Swans cover of Love Will Tear Us Apart, which significantly, in one small element, changes the melody of the chorus, which is, I think, a very strange thing to do anyway. And it's clearly a cover version because it's Love Will Tear Us Apart, and what else could it be? But the idea of kind of putting your stamp on it by saying, well, actually, this bit of the melody, these four notes, I'm going to play these other three notes instead. So that every time it comes to that bit, you're just thinking, like, why did you do that?
Sounds great. That sounds like a really, you know.
It sounds like a good thing, but it's.
You unnerve people every time.
Yeah.
Is it not actually good?
Well, there's that subset of stuff on the internet where they play songs that are in major keys, in minor keys, and vice versa to show how they would be wholly different.
There is the song that is still in Only Love Can Break Your Heart, where they took a fairly staid waltz time song just by changing the time signature. And then by adding this kind of shuffling beat, you really change the whole feel of the song. That does very strongly help.
I mean, I think replacing Neil Young on a Neil Young song often makes a significant difference as well. As much as his voice is iconic, it has certain qualities which make him less good to listen to in a club.
Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful covers album by Katie Lang, Hymns of the 49th Parallel, which is just her covering songs by other Canadians. And it's, I mean, her voice is amazing, but it is very interesting to have stuff where you're so used to someone else's very specific sort of voice on a very, you know, canonical song, and it just produces you do have this feeling of this song is now her own, except for her version of Hallelujah, which is like every version of Hallelujah, a cover of the Rufus Wainwright version of Hallelujah, and as such, like, I mean, doesn't need to exist, was a terrible idea, should have been got rid of.
Poor old Leonard Cohen. I mean, there are artists like Leonard Cohen who are eminently coverable, partially because they're great songwriters, but who have very distinctive.
Who were born with the gift of a golden voice.
Well, delivery,
he was
yeah,
born
indeed.
As well, with the golden voice.
but it's a voice that other people might want to replace and do it their way, and because they haven't got a golden voice, it will sound somewhat different.
Is Dylan's golden voice also in this category any chance? It's a very interesting way of looking at it, because it genuinely hadn't really occurred to me that the reason people cover Dylan songs is because there's a large demand for Dylan songs not sung by Dylan. But actually, of course, yes, there is.
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, you know, that Dylan, Neil Young, people like that, Cohen, you know, have voiced a bit, Joni Mitchell up to a point as well, have very, very distinctive voices, but also are, you know, really, really, really great songwriters, and so therefore the song's a fair game. But you would always say they were covers because the original is very distinctive and there as part of that artist canon.
I remember when the Slits version of Heard It Through the Grapevine came out, it was actually played on the name of that BBC a Radio 1 show where they would play the new songs that came out, and then a bunch of people would comment on them. But at this particular one, and it was sort of 79, so it often had like curious and interesting un-Radio 1-ish kind of songs on it, because Radio 1 really hadn't yet adapted to the this burst of new types of music that were coming out. And one of the people on the panel that particular episode was Ian Paid of the much lamented mod band Secret Affair. And he could not have been more offended and outraged by the Slits version of Heard It Through the Grapevine. I mean, he was genuinely like upset and angry that such a version existed, which was just a really interesting kind of territorial battle going on. Like, what did the Slits feel they were doing by covering this song? How did he, from a different genre, which was in battle with whatever you actually described this genre as, how did he feel about it? Both of them having an attitude towards the original song, which was, in his case, obviously somewhat possessed. And it's an era where you really feel there's a sort of back and forth between different genres for sort of dominance of the music space had shifted from being something like the Austro-Hungarian Empire being like rock covering the whole of Europe. That had all fragmented into lots of bits which were all like warring against one another to maybe perhaps to become some great empire themselves one day. But at the time, everything was quite small and quite local, and there was lots of alliances being made, hostile takeovers, weird plays for reinterpreting things. There was a lot of little electronic bands doing covers of 50s rock and roll songs. There was a Japanese band called The Plastics whose thing was that they were very electronic and very sort of dinky and keyboards and whatever. And they did a cover version of Long Distance Information, I guess a Chuck Berry song. And the idea was that it was a sort of a creative transformation to say, look, this song, as an indication of the era we are entering, it is both funny and entertaining for us to do this excellent, as it happened, version of this old classic that you all know, because in the future, all music will sound like us, not like him.
What you were saying about the kind of shot across the bows between genres and kind of staking out a thing, I've been going through as part of the kind of peripheral content on the Twitter poll. I've been going through YouTube and finding people's comments,
yeah.
And snipping bits of them. And one on the Scissor Sisters version of Comfortably Numb, they said, "I love this song, but I also wish it had more than 180 downvotes." So it was clearly like the value in that song is the idea that somebody might listen to it and have a reaction like the Secret Affair reaction. You've kind of got this idealized audience who's getting angry at the song in your head. And that seemed to me to be sort of an interesting response. Is it like, cover versions can be a kind of trolling,
yes,
of another genre, of another set of fans.
Absolutely.
And you can align yourself, with the set of fans that you identify with and kind of create this straw person. And of course, in fact, there'll be a couple of kind of disgusted of umma-gumma people deciding that this cover is indeed a blasphemy. But the vast majority will think, haha, that is quite funny. It is Comfortably Numb done in a disco style.
Yeah.
Which has a sort of a historical context. Yeah. There's a historical context there, which at the time would have been perhaps unheard of. But when it actually came out, I mean, my dad loved the Scissor Sisters version, partially because it was like, oh, look, young people's bands listen to old people's music conversation and thought it was done really well and actually done quite intelligently, which I wholly agree with.
Yes, I'm not sure I could pin down what the Slits version of it was, but some of their sort of journey was a journey from people who really couldn't play at all to people who discovered in themselves a way of performing which didn't really exist before then, and were kind of trying out songs which already existed to see if you could translate them into the sound that they'd invented. I think that is some of what was going on, whereas the Secret Affair guy's position was this is classic music which shouldn't be messed with, and if it is to be interpreted at all, it is to be interpreted by young men in smart suits bellowing.
Keeping it tight. Yeah. I think that thing of the cover as a kind of a way of enriching your own music, the cover is a way of kind of bringing new things in, is an underappreciated manifestation of the idea. So Turi Tantafe Wong, I always think of this in the context of her
There's this one album where she covers the Cocteau Twins and the Cranberries, and they're extremely straight covers, but part of that is just about bringing this sound into her music, demonstrating that she's that this is the sound that she's interested in, and then she changes her own music to follow in that direction. And I think you find that every so often, that you find there's a kind of, the cover is a statement of intent about where you're going, rather than pulling this other song towards yourself, but pulling you away and onto new things.
To bring up again a song less good than Faye Wong's, the U2 Night and Day, it was very interesting to me that it hadn't kind of twigged where it was in their chronology, and it was the thing that they did just after they'd done Rattle and Hum, which of course is an album full of atrocious cover version. And then they'd done this thing.
What do you mean?
Yeah, some of which don't. They
invented the blues.
They did invent the blues. Sorry, they returned to their blues roots on Rattle and Hum.
And they took back Helter Skelter from Charles Manson.
I haven't heard. Yeah. they stole it back. But then, obviously, the reaction to Rattle and Hum wasn't quite as favourable, perhaps, as Bono had hoped. So they then went and did Night and Day. And to me, having never heard it before, it sounded like a complete mess. But also, it clearly invented their sound for the next sort of 5-6 years, because it's their first, now we're a band that does things with loops, and we're kind of postmodern and sort of, you know, assuming a character and all this kind of thing. So it definitely showed them a place where they could go, which they felt was productive, and which, I mean, it worked out very well for them in terms of maintaining their relevance into the 90s. Whether it was a good thing from my perspective as a listener.
It seems a pity. It's actually a really good 30s song, Night and Day. And I feel there are better cover versions than U2's. You'll be shocked to hear that I'm claiming that.
Doing the polls, obviously, there's always a kind of something of a kind of chronological crunch, because most of the people taking part are, I would guess, probably 10 years either side of my age. So I think that it sort of telescopes into stuff that was big in the 80s, big in the 90s, and doesn't go much further. But one thing that kind of occurred to me is now, you know, anyone can and does do a cover. All you need to do a cover and to sort of get your cover potentially seen by millions is a video camera and a musical instrument and access to the internet.
I mean, karaoke is a cover. It's a cover. I mean, that's what that is.
Is it? Is it?
Well, it is.
It can
in some
be
ways,
a
I mean,
cover.
It can be. I mean, it can also be. Trust me. Okay.
I think sometimes you're just doing a standard.
I guess is the kind of age of the iconic cover over? Is the industrialization of covers? Pete, you mentioned the Live Lounge earlier, and that very much is a kind of production line of covers done to a particular.
Yeah, it's a shtick, isn't it? It's a part of the show, and there've been TV shows, as a famous Australian show where everyone did Stairway to Heaven, where that Rolf Harris. I don't know why I keep talking about Terrible Abusers on this, but Rolf Harris's version of Stairway to Heaven came from. And so yeah, I mean it's just shtick. I mean, you know, and I dare say there's a moment when you talk to Jules Holland's team on later, and they go, could you do us a cover? Could it have some boogie woogie piano in it? I mean, it's going to, exactly. If you like it or not. So it is a, and I think if you're a small band, that's what they want, because again, they want to show your chops. So I thought that the age of the sort of great cover was over until, you know, again, say something like the Scissor Sisters turns up and it's a band doing something that throws you up. But there haven't been that many great ones.
That's 15 years old, though.
Has there been? What's the most recent sort of big notable cover that people can
well,
think of?
Well, we come into the John Lewis covers, don't we? The John Lewis covers hit this perfectly, because they are big hits. They are reinterpretations of songs to fit a certain marketing need.
I mean, the most recent cover that got to number one was the Amazon exclusive version of Joni Mitchell's River that was sung by, was it Ellie Goulding?
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
And there's
she really
I mean my mother so, recently
yeah, exactly. She really put her stamp on it.
I recently used my internet powers to find for my mother the Narina Palette cover of Love Will Tear Us Apart, which was featured on television's Normal People.
Oh yes.
which she was incredibly excited about and really wanted to listen to. And that was a, so, you know, that thing of the smoothed out female song, drippy ballad version of a song, you know, is definitely like,
you still get
richly alive.
Yeah, you get that all over adverts. I was, and there is an advert doing the rounds at the moment which has a breathy lady doing True Faith by New Order, which is horrific. Oh, but the day has come. The other thing about doing that kind of thing is that you don't actually need to kind of conceptualize how the whole song is going to be like. All you need is like 30 seconds worth, enough for people to recognize what it is and think, oh, that's nice. And then
they're often the kind of cover which skips from like the famous line that you know to the famous line that you know. They're the ones where you have that thing where they'll sing like the first two lines and then
and then they'll just miss out a load.
Well, like that, what was the British, was it a British Gas advert that had the strings off the Universal by Blur but were like just changed just enough that they didn't have to pay them royalties? Or that was the feeling that you got from it.
There's
a kind of, you know, that they're pushing, I mean, it's the same, like you're at a wedding disco familiarity thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an exercise in nostalgia. Hmm. It's an exercise in nostalgia, and cover versions often are, because, you know, that's, they're saying, you remember this, you like this song, well, we're going to do it well, badly, whatever, but you still want to carry over some of your affection for the original version of the song. So in theory, it's kind of a win-win.
I think this is a, if we're going to suggest that the era of the big cover version might be on the way out, it could be because when we were all listening to the radio as kids, like the version of Total Eclipse of the Heart by Nikki French that was on like a Now tape in 1994 or something, was, when I was a child, the only version. I hadn't heard the original, and I, you know, I just didn't hear the original until like 6 years later or something, probably earlier than that, at which point I realized. But there's a kind of, if you live in the era of Spotify, you can hear the original of a song pretty fast, so you don't have that sense of like, this cover is, this is possibly the first version of this. You, every cover to you already exists within an ecosystem of other versions, and also within an ecosystem of just infinite songs.
I think this is also the issue that Frank Cogan raised, which is regarding X Factor versions of songs, where the new artist does a great version of an old standard, but they don't do it significantly differently to make it their own, because they can't, because they need to be recognised as being good at the technical act of doing the song. So they're, but also
the kind of Stars in Your Eyes version.
Yeah, and the first thing that happens as well is that people then go running back to Spotify to hear the original and then go, oh yeah, that is a classic, isn't it? And then, you know, the new version is, you know, is no good to them. They didn't need Alexandra Burke's version of it because they've got, actually that was a particularly bad example, they've got all the other versions.
Hers is the only version we will ever need.
So I think, you know, on that gloomy note of decline,
No future. It's good. Destroy everything.
We end. On that optimistic note of destroying, to begin anew, we end. So thank you, everyone. We'll be back next month on this yet-to-be-named podcast series, where we will be discussing the year 1990, because that is what the next poll is. And nobody's nominated U2's Night and Day, I'm delighted to say. So, yeah, thanks to Sis, Mark and Pete, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Freaky Trigger and the Pollards of Lock, a podcast by Freaky Trigger UK. I'm Tom Ewing, and joining me on this month's podcast were Sis Noel-Smith, Mark Sinker and Pete Barron. To take part in the Twitter polls upon which these podcasts are based, please subscribe to People's Pop on Twitter and check back to Freaky Trigger UK for this episode and future episodes. Thanks for listening.